Ready? Okay. Will you help with Blackboard? Thanks. Because then I can stand rather than sit. You know, that's the point, number one. Number two, it's that I forgot to bring the other laptop, so it would be difficult to monitor both the PowerPoint and the Blackboard. So, thanks. Yeah, sure. I did so, I mean, a moment ago, I didn't see many people there, but it's probably because it was early. Is there anyone now? Yeah. Okay, people coming in. Yeah, whatever. We don't know how many are watching the streaming. But according to the feedback that Stephen got when he asked about preferences on physical lectures and remote, most people are watching videos, they said, and, or at most streaming. Anyway. That's fine. I mean, since you have the option, this is okay. Good. So, this is almost where we left last time. I did say a few things about vulnerabilities, but just to make the connection to where we were last time. So, this is just a few statistics about the problem of vulnerabilities. I mean, one of the problems, the big problems that we have in cybersecurity, not only about critical infrastructures, but in a more general sense, is that the artifacts that we are using have vulnerabilities. Right? I mean, if you can imagine a situation where there are no vulnerabilities, and vulnerability is a weakness, right? That's what it is. If you could imagine a situation where the artifacts that we are using, programs, hardware, whatever, do not have vulnerabilities, then we wouldn't have a problem with security. Right? I mean, but unfortunately, this is not the case. So in our case, I'm focusing on industrial control systems vulnerabilities because this is where the heart is of critical infrastructures. Yes, Marius. I can try. I mean, we used it last time. It's always this problem. Okay, let me try to get it on. The thing is that everything is confusing when more than one thing appears on the screen and so on. Can you hear me on Blackboard? Okay. Then, well, I'm sorry, but I will sit down again then because otherwise it doesn't work. Okay, so you have to choose either me standing up like a proper lecture or sitting down and having good sound, but I guess I don't need to hear the answer. I know what the answer is. Okay, let's see now. Wow, okay, we got it working. So, as I was saying, we are focusing, of course, on industrial control systems because these are the core of critical infrastructures. And this is just to show you the extent of the problem. So, one of the certs, the agencies for issuing vulnerability alerts, 354. Cybersecurity advisors, and all these, of course, reported vulnerabilities of some sort. So it's quite big. And well, the more annoying or concerning thing is that there was an increase by 30%. And if you go back, you will see that the figures for 2020 were higher than those for 2019, and so on and so forth. So actually, it goes like this, See? It's not even linear, unfortunately. Of course, one might argue that, yes, because there are more artifacts out there, we are doing more intense, a more intense job of locating vulnerabilities, of advising about them, and so on. But the fact remains that there are more vulnerabilities every year, right? Okay. We will talk about CVEs. This is a common vulnerability enumeration thing. That we will, I'll explain what this is later on, right? So the takeaway from this one is, number one, that vulnerabilities are growing. Okay. Number two, well, this is not so important, but still, the advisories are split like this. The providers of those artifacts that had vulnerabilities, and the lion's share here goes to Siemens. But again, this is explainable because in ICSs you would expect to find the Siemens component in almost every ICS. Of course, there are other companies that produce equipment like this, like ABB, like Schneider Electric, like Mitsubishi. All of them are producing such equipment, but the dominant player, I think, in the domain is Siemens. So it's expected that they would have the most vulnerabilities as well. Right? Yes, and this is, again, we will discuss what a CVSS score is, but let me now, for now, it's sufficient for you to know that the CVSS is a metric, or a score, the CVSS score is a metric of how bad a vulnerability is. Okay, so what you can say from these from this graph here is that the badness of vulnerabilities does not really fluctuate too much, except for a particular particular year here, right? Particular kind of vulnerability here score, which is a very it's an exception. So nothing to worth discussing. Now, trends. Yeah, I think we already already discussed this. The critical manufacturing sector is the most affected one, and again, because the digital transformation is more intense in the manufacturing sector. Again, this explains things, but. Almost half of the vulnerabilities reported could impact more than one sector. Again, reasonable, because vulnerabilities pertain to equipment which is used across sectors. So it doesn't have to be a particular one. And the decrease in the number of vulnerabilities affecting multiple products is decreased, but still there is a sufficient number of them. And we already commented on the country of origin of the vulnerability, because Siemens is in Germany, of course, so this is where most are found. Now, there is a number of sources that you can use to learn about vulnerabilities. And by learning, I don't mean the just the academic learning, like in a course, like in this course, right? But for your own professional work. Because obviously what security experts around the world are doing, one of the tasks is try to reduce the vulnerabilities of the infrastructure they are supposed to protect. It's not only, of course, about reducing the vulnerabilities, it's about also reducing the likelihood of threats, right, or reducing the impact, and reducing the impact, but definitely having less vulnerabilities is something we would like to have. So these are all sources that security professionals should, in fact, consult when they treat vulnerabilities. Now let's look at them into more some more detail. The National Vulnerability Database, this is actually a source which is, it's a repository of information. So there is quite much there. I don't know if I can manage to get you the – Yeah, I can see it on my screen, but you can't see it there anyway. The site, I mean. But anyway, this is not really what, really not important in this case. But maybe then no, doesn't work like that. Sorry. Okay, so it's a repository of standards-based vulnerability management data. You can find all sorts of information under DNVD. Actually, it's an umbrella site where it has links to other sites, the other sources, some of the other sources that I mentioned. And there is a specific protocol called SCAP, which is used there. They say that this data enables the automation of vulnerability management. But this is a little bit of exaggeration, because in order to automate vulnerability management, there is more that you need to do than just the SCAP to communicate vulnerability data. In any case, what you have there are databases of security checklist references, so you can check whether your site or your artifact checks against those. There are software flaws, obviously related security, bugs related to security, misconfigurations, product names, impact metrics, you can find it there. Now, the second source, and this is quite extensively used, is what we call the Common Vulnerability Enumeration. It's the CVE thing. Now, this is a program which again goes under the DNVD. And the program, it started by MITRE, I think. Yes, the MITRE organization. And the mission is to identify, define, and catalog cybersecurity vulnerabilities, of course, those that are publicly disclosed. I mean, you cannot disclose something which is not publicly known. For each vulnerability, there is one record. And how do these records increase? How are they informed? Well, they are discovered by anyone or by collaborating organizations. This is kind of a crowdsourcing policy. So anyone that discovers a vulnerability can inform the database. Of course, there is a process for getting information in there so that no information which is inaccurate will find its way into the database. So this is the way it works, and this is how it looks like. Okay, we will see another slide with more detail on that, but it's a textual description of a vulnerability, right? So in this example there is of course a code for each vulnerability. This is the year of discovery, and then this is just a number is used to identify each vulnerability. And this is the text that goes with it, right? So you can see that this text is broken down into several parts, but still it is unstructured text. So you see here, first of all, the code, the ID, right? Then you see what the weakness is. Fail to authenticate against configured passwords when, and so on and so forth. You see the affected product. Did I lose my pointer? Well, this one instead. Yes. So you see the affected product, right? It's a Zimatic, that's a PLC by Siemens, programmable logic controller. You see the attack vector, so how the vulnerability can be exploited. This is here, using the TIA portal V13 or later versions to bypass authentication. And you see the impact here. Download arbitrary programs into the PLC. But still, is this something that you can automatically process by this kind of verbal information? No. And this is actually an open item. And this is what this is one of the things that this PhD thesis, which is very recent actually, the defense was a couple of weeks ago, I was the opponent, did. So put together information from all these sources about vulnerabilities in a manner which is much more useful for professionals to use and leverage. Anyway, so this is how it looks like, but this is only one part of the record. We will see a record of the CVE later on, a full record. Then we have the common weakness enumeration, which is CWE. Again, crowdsourcing kind of thing, community-developed list of software and hardware weaknesses. They call them weaknesses, they are vulnerabilities again. Right now, version 4.8, if you go to the link there, you will see that the list has about 927, at least it had last week when I checked. Maybe there are more today. And they are classified into several classes. So you will see their software development, hardware design, research concepts, or other. And each one of them is clickable, and you can see the full list of weaknesses when you do that. Then another piece of useful information is the known exploited vulnerabilities catalog. Now, what is the difference of this against what we have already discussed? This gives you vulnerabilities that we know that have been exploited. So you could say that this is more concrete information, because the other vulnerabilities, yes, they have been discovered. Yes, we know, and it is described in the CVE, for example, how they can be exploited or what the impact could be. But this has not been documented in the real world. So what this gives you is vulnerabilities that have been exploited, and we know what the result was. Obviously, this list is much shorter, right? And it doesn't mean that if a vulnerability is not there, it has not been exploited. It's only that we don't know that it has been exploited, which are two different things, obviously. And then that, I'm sure that you have heard about Shodan, have you? Yeah? No? Okay. Well, actually, Shodan is not a vulnerability list or a vulnerability source. It's a search engine which you can use to find information about Internet of Things artifacts. So you can, it used to be free, but I think it's not anymore any longer. So you can use it to identify, you can search for a particular product like a web camera or anything you like, anything that can be classified as an IoT artifact, and then it will give you information on the product, including also known vulnerabilities. And then we have the CERT-CC Vulnerability Nodes database, and this is only about software, so it doesn't touch hardware at all. The notes give you summaries, they don't give you details, technical details, how to mitigate the vulnerability, and also where these vulnerabilities can be found in certain products of vendors. And here, the way this is compiled is private coordination and also disclosure. Thinking of the word, are you familiar with the notion of responsible disclosure? Marius nods yes. Do we have anyone else in Blackboard nodding yes? Marius? Yes, of course. Yeah, but they listen on the Blackboard channel live, so yeah. But anyway, okay. Marius, would you care to explain what is responsible disclosure? And I will repeat, of course. Right. So what Mario said, I will just repeat, it was absolutely correct, that responsible disclosure is the process that you must follow if you discover a vulnerability or a weakness, right? Then what do? Do you just go out and shout, I found a vulnerability and this is how you can use it to the world? I mean, obviously not. So the responsible, this is the irresponsible disclosure. The responsible disclosure process, according to that process, you need first to notify the producer, right? The vendor. And tell them, I have found this, please fix it. And again, Marius is right, you give them a reasonable length of time to fix the vulnerability, which is usually 3 months, yes. After that, you can go public, regardless of whether they have fixed it or not. Those of you that might be involved in this process or get involved in the future, you will find out that not every vendor fixes vulnerabilities within the 90 days. So sometimes we are obliged to release the vulnerability after this period, because you see there is an ethical dilemma there. Obviously, if you disclose a vulnerability, you make it easier for attackers to exploit it, right? So this argument would go towards the direction of not disclosing. But on the other hand, if you disclose it, it means that you warn those that have to defend systems that there is this vulnerability, and you give them the chance of patching it, right? So the weight usually goes on to disclosing rather than keeping it under wraps, right? This is where the balance goes. Yes, Marius. Oh, yes. Yep. Again, two very good comments by Marius. The first one is that it's not uncommon that vendors would try to prevent you from publicly disclosing a vulnerability by publishing, for example. That's the one thing. And the other one is that it's not uncommon that the vendors, again, would try to gain some time to fix the vulnerability beyond the 90 days. But again, I will stress these two are absolutely valid points, but again, I would stress the fact that sometimes they don't even care. And it's always a question of investment that has to be put into fixing it. If it is something easy, then they will do it. But if it takes a lot of investment, then they will simply delay fixing it until perhaps the next version of the product is out, in which, of course, it will be fixed anyway. Okay. Then CVSS. This is all the sources that we've discussed up till now. They actually give you information, of course, about vulnerabilities, but they don't give you any indication of how bad vulnerability is, what is the extent of the vulnerability. Now, CVSS is a source that gives you that kind of information, and you can infer this, of course, by the use of the word scoring. So it gives you a numerical score against each vulnerability. As you can read there, this is owned and managed by FIRST. This is an organization of first incident responses, centers, and so on and so forth. It's non-for-profit, so it's not a private organization as that. And the mission, of course, is to help the public interest. The way that the score is computed, the CVSS uses three metric groups, and you will see these in the next slide. So there are three metric groups. The base metric group, and you can see what this comprises here. There is the exploitability metrics, which give you a measure of how exploitable is the vulnerability. Just as an example, what is the attack vector that can exploit the vulnerability? If there is no attack that can exploit the vulnerability, we really don't care about the vulnerability, right? I mean, this metric would be very, very low. Of course, it's only in theory that there exists a vulnerability that no attack can exploit it. I mean, this is highly unlikely. But this is just to give you an idea of how this works. And then, of course, the attack complexity. If it, the attack that needed to exploit the vulnerability is too complex, then obviously this makes the vulnerability less exploitable, because it requires more skills, more resources on the side of the attacker and so on. And likewise, I mean, I don't think we need to go into each one of them. The user interaction and the privileges required. User interaction is the location of the attacker, the required location, so that he or she can actually launch the attack. And then you have the impact metrics under the same group. So here, of course, we have the three attributes of security: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So what is the impact in each one of the three? All these give you a measure, right? And then, of course, they will be put together and give you a one unique score in the end. So this is the first group. Then you have the temporal metric group. And again, here you have three subcategories here. And finally, the environmental metric group with those sub metrics shown here. And again, it's recommended that you consult the site of CVSS and see how it works, not in much detail, but as I said, this is something that you will be using in your professional life, so it's good to expose yourself on how this works. So this is a list of the metrics, right? So for each one, the three categories that we already discussed, and then the metrics under each one of the categories. And here are the possible values that each one of these metrics can take. And as you can see, these are not numerical values, right? They are rather qualitative or textual. In the sense that, for example, I'm not entirely certain of what each one of them means, in the sense that they are the initials of the words, the words. We have to go to the site to make sure what they are. But for example, I think L stands for low, H stands for high. This is the easy one, and then you have a non-applicable one and things like this, right? So these are the possible values. And then, oh, you have the last field tells you whether it is a mandatory field to be completed when you fill in the sheet of the vulnerability or not. And some of them are mandatory, some of them are not. And if they are not there, they do not contribute to the overall score. Now, an obvious question is, okay, and how do we produce a score, a numerical score, if we have all that? Well, obviously there is some kind of mapping algorithm which maps your scores in textual, the acronyms there, to some kind of numerical numerical value. I'm not sure whether I have a slide on this. I don't, because this is a level of detail that you might want to look at, but it's not really necessary. All you need to know for the purpose, for our purposes here at least, is that there is a way of mapping those characteristics, right, to a numerical score. And actually there, you will find, if you visit the site, you will see that there are two algorithms. So the result is that we have a CVSS version 2 and a CVSS version 3, because the algorithm changes, the mapping algorithm to the score changes. And this is an example of a particular vulnerability, how it looks like in the CVSS. So you have the name of the vulnerability, and this is the ID coming from the CVE, right? So there is cross reference there. Then you have the description, which again comes from the CVE. You can see the sources here, right? And then it also refers to the NVD, that's the publishing, the date of publication, and so on and so forth. And then again, finally, you have what you see here, the score. Base score is 10, which is calculated on the basis of these inputs, These are the metrics. Right? The algorithm is used. The details are not there. They're not of interest. Right? But it gives you a base score of 10 in the CVSS version 2. The score in SVSS version 3 would be different because there are some differences there in the algorithm. But again, the relevant, the relative position and the relative score is what matters. Because obviously, the higher the score, these are the vulnerabilities you need to pay more attention to. Okay? And this is the vector for describing it. Not very user-friendly, is it? But it can be used as a basis for an automated kind of processing here. Fine. And also what is interesting, because someone might wonder, okay, do these vulnerabilities, we have vulnerabilities that are there since 2017, right? Are they still relevant? Do they still exist? And that's 5 years ago. What do you think? Keeping in mind also the discussion we had about the disclosure. Yes, Marius. Yes. Yep. Absolutely. So the answer was that if a vulnerability was patched in 2017, that doesn't necessarily mean that it has vanished, because there will be systems out there that have not been updated. That's a very simple reason, right? So this is then a slide showing you how the vulnerabilities evolve in time, right? And in relation to the risk. So in the beginning, when the vulnerability is created, then it cannot be measured, really, obviously, right? And then at some point, it is discovered, right? What does that mean? Because of the responsible disclosure, there is, before the discovery, before disclosure, there is a period of time between discovery and disclosure. And in this period, the risk is high. Why is it high? After all, it has not been disclosed, right? Isn't that a contradiction? Yeah. Exactly. This is the reason that it's only the good guys that have found the vulnerability and have not disclosed it, right? There is also attack groups, yes, that might have found it, and because it has not been disclosed, and because it has not been disclosed, it has not been fixed, the risk is higher, yes? Yes. Yes, as well. This is also part of the answer, yes. So the risk is higher, number one, because there are people out there that know about the vulnerability, yes, others than those that discovered it, and B, because the solution has not yet been found. Okay, good. And then after disclosure, we know it, right? So the risk goes down, why? Because, of course, the solution has not yet been found. See where the patch comes? So the second reason has not been activated yet. But the first one, once it has been made public, then the risk is reduced. Why? Because people know about that. Okay. So the risk is less here than what it is there. Okay. People are at least aware, right? Even though the patch is not yet available. And of course, after the patch, the risk should go down. Fine. Now, then you might feel very comfortable about vulnerabilities. We know them all. We have lists. We have measures. We have scores. We have advisories, right? We are not helpless in that domain. Is this absolutely true? Well, I can't read that. It's too small, so I'll go closer to the to the screen. Oh, yes. Advisories, right? We talked about advisories from the certs. Would you take them for granted? The answer is you shouldn't. 38% contain errors, right? And what does that mean? Well, if a vulnerability advisory gives you a wrong impression of how bad or how important the vulnerability is, then you will not prioritize it, and you will prioritize it wrongly with respect to other vulnerabilities, right? But even worse, 35% of the advisors could cause both a loss of you and loss of control. So by trying to fix the vulnerability in the way the advisors tell you to do it, you might actually do more harm than the vulnerability itself, because it's not certain that the vulnerability will be exploited. But if you try to fix it in a wrong way, then you will probably do more harm. Okay? So beware of that. Believe the advisors, use them, but be critical about them. Okay, then, this is also interesting in the sense that it gives you an idea. This is a heat map, right? Are you familiar with what a heat map is? Good. Okay, then these are sectors. Sectors of industrial control systems. They are prioritized according to the number of incidents that we had in the past year. And this is why you see manufacturing up top, because it amounted for 70% of the incidents in 2021. And what you have on the horizontal axis is the vulnerabilities that were found by this particular company, right? Dragos, which is one of the major vendors in the area worldwide. The vulnerabilities that were found in their customers when they were analyzing the situation, right? So the vulnerabilities, they were classified in four classes: external connectivity, shared credentials, poor perimeters, and limited visibility. Are they more or less understood what we mean? Well, external connectivity, of course, it means what? That the OT system, the operational technology system, or the industrial control system was externally connected. Right, so it practically available through the internet. That's what it means. Shared credentials, easy. Sharing passwords, okay? A practice that we always tell people not to do, but people will continue doing, whatever we do. Yeah, and this is for organizational purposes. It's simply practical. When you change shifts in a factory, right, it's much, much easier to have a shared password between shifts rather than having to log in every time that you change that. So it's human nature. Okay? Should expect it. Then poor perimeter, of course, because in a networked environment with external connectivity, you cannot have a well-defined perimeter of the system that you're trying to defend by definition. And then finally, limited visibility, which means what? We don't really have situational awareness of what is going on in the system that we're trying to protect, okay? And the heat map tells you that, unfortunately, at least in the manufacturing sector, all three of them are very frequent, right? And one, the shared credentials, is common. So it's not a very good situation. If you compare to other sectors, you will not see much of a difference, right? Except for the nuclear sector down here, where you see that black here means rare, but this is expectable, right? I mean, the nuclear sector has so much in terms of safety requirements, security requirements, and so on, that it would be really surprising to find vulnerabilities of that sort there. Now, for going further, I need to make a slight deviation and talk a little bit about the Purdue model of enterprises. Have you heard about that? Anyone on Blackboard? I would be surprised if you had, so don't be shy. Say no. Okay, so the Purdue model of an enterprise is a model that gives you It's a reference architecture, right, of how information systems originally, because it was developed back in the 80s, back then we only had information systems or information technology, how it is structured into a factory, into a shop floor. Okay? And the basic things you need to know about it here is that we have these levels here. Okay? So down here, you have the physical process, whatever it is. Could be manufacturing, it could be nuclear, it could be electrical, it could be anything. Then you have level one, where you have equipment which is directly connected to the physical infrastructure. Level two, coming up one level, all this is what we call cell or area zones. Then you have the industrial security zone. This is firewalled, and this is also firewalled on this side. So here is what we call the demilitarized zone, or the DMZ. It's a level designed to air gap the enterprise systems that we have up here with the industrial systems that we have down there, right? And in theory, this should be sufficient. We know that it's not. Kay? But anyway, again, what you need to know from this is the fact that we can model a situation in a factory, in a shop floor, by modeling it in these different layers. And in fact, the last layer also includes not only the enterprise network, but it can include the cloud and so on, which is the trend nowadays. Now, keep that in mind, and let me give you the next slide on vulnerabilities. Now, this is where the vulnerabilities that were discovered in 2021 or existed in 2021 resided with respect to this model. So 23% of the advisories were advisories related to products up here. And then you have 56% of the vulnerabilities analyzed at levels 2 and 3, so lower, right? Control, this is actually the industrial control system, right? And finally, 21% down level 0 and 1. If you look at it all together, what does it tell you? The biggest part of vulnerabilities is in the OT network. Okay. Is that expected? Yes, the answer is yes. Why? Because this technology has never been meant to be secure. It has never been designed to be secure. And now we have put it together with IT technology up top. So this is the result, right? Unfortunately, yes. Oh, and the final part, this it's this right-hand side of this slide. One might ask, okay, what is the composition of these vulnerabilities in terms of things that we need to do about them? Well, 4.2% of vulnerabilities that you need to remediate. 53% vulnerabilities that you need to mitigate. Again, expected. I mean, this is the vast majority. 34%, monitor it, but not be over-concerned with this. And only 8.8%, you can forget. So again, the vast majority is here, which means that all these sources are actually useful, right? Okay, any questions here? Otherwise, it's time to break before we go into the risk discussion about risk. Anything on Blackboard, Marius? No? Okay. Then 15 minutes. Shall we resume? Okay, so last part of session two. I hope we can make it within this hour. If not, we will continue, of course, next time. So it's about risk. Let me start by discussing a bit the concept of risk. Of course, today the risk, and in a cybersecurity context, we know what risk is and we perceive it as security risk, right? But it hasn't always been like that. Initially, the term and the concept was defined in the 17th century, and it was defined in France, actually. It was related to gambling. I don't know how many of you know how the probability theory was established and why. What was the motivation? Any ideas? No? Well, it was a very practical thing. You know, back then in the 17th century, the French were very keen in gambling, all sorts of gambling, cards, dice, whatever. And at one particular instance, what had happened is that two persons were playing a game. It doesn't matter what exactly the game was. And for some reason, beyond their control, they had to interrupt the game. And of course, the game, you put in money at every move and so on and so forth. Right? So the question came up, how do we split whatever was on the table in terms of money, right? What's the obvious choice? Just split it in two, right? Yes, but is this the most fair? Is it the fairest option? The answer is no, because we know now that the probability of someone who had so many points already to win the game, as opposed to the probability of someone who had less points, is larger, right? Is bigger. And therefore, this should be reflected in the way that the money on the table should be split. But at that time, this was not known. So what they did, they asked a mathematician of that period. It was actually Mr. Cauchy, who was the founder of the theory of probability. And he realized that the answer was quite simple. But this was the foundations then of probability theory. And of course, risk is very much related to probability theory. So after that, people knew what they were risking in playing cards or dice or any other form of gambling. But that's what it was. And the important thing here is to realize that risk is a combination of likelihood, what is likely to happen, and the profit or the loss, right? Which in today's terms, we could say that this is the impact. Right? Well, of course, it's one form of impact. It's only financial impact, but still it is impact. Then, in the 18th century, the concept migrated to the UK. At that time, the UK were, of course, very advanced in the maritime sector. There was ships were sailing across the world. But obviously, they were not as secure and safe as they are today. So when they met with extreme weather conditions, they would simply sink. And of course, the cargo would be lost, which means that the insurance industry was devised. But of course, any insurance industry to thrive, it needs a measure of what is the risk of insuring something. And this is when the concept of risk came into the maritime industry. Then, one century later, risk started appearing in economic sciences, and it was related to the risk of investment. What is the risk of investing in this and getting my money back or losing money? And finally, in the 20th century, well, it's not finally, we are in the 21st, but still it's the same thing. We have no big differences in the concept of risk. Risk took a negative meaning. Up till then, there was nothing negative there, right? It was just one metric used to guide decisions. But then In the 20th century, risk has been linked to environmental risks from technological process, progress, and so on and so forth. Now, when it comes, though, to cybersecurity risk, things are a little bit easier for us to define. Information security, in information security, risk, which we denote by R, of course, is defined as a product. Likelihood times the cost that the breach, the security breach, will bring. So in terms of definition, it is a simple product of likelihood times cost or impact. Then one, of course, would wonder what is the likelihood of an event happening. Is it related to other attributes? And the answer is yes. And we know that this is related to the likelihood of a threat to occur and of the intensity or of the severity of the vulnerability that the threat will exploit. And the cost is the impact upon the assets. So this is how we define risk in information security. Some of you have probably heard this before in any risk management course. Now, the formal definitions, if you go to the ISO standards, the 27,000 family of standards, the latest definition is the top one. So risk is the effect of uncertainty on objectives. This doesn't say much in terms of cybersecurity. I don't know whether you understand more than what I understand from that. I don't. The reason why this is there, it's because ISO made a decision, strategic decision, to align the definition of risk across all its standards. So you will find the same definition for environmental risk, the same definition for economic risk, and the same definition for cybersecurity risk. So personally, what I prefer is the older definition of the ISO standard of what risk is, the potential that the threat will exploit the vulnerability and will bring some impact. I think that this is much more relevant to cybersecurity than the current formal definition. And you may want to think of risk like that. Now that we know what risk is, let's see how we can measure it. Well, formally, we should be using what a sector of probability theory and statistics, which is called Bayes statistics. You're familiar with Bayes statistics? Anyone? Have you heard the term before? You must have, but you don't remember it. Well, basically, what it is, it's this branch of statistics that answers the question, if I know what has happened in the past, can I somehow predict the future? This is what Bayes statistics is about. Okay? So formally, we should be using this. And we do, but not so formally necessarily in information security. Now, but this is the theoretical basis. The important elements in measuring risk is, of course, the elements that constitute risk. So we need to measure the value of the elements in the system. Okay. Then we need to know the likelihood of the threat to occur and the likelihood of a vulnerability, or more than one, to be exploited. So if we can measure each one of those factors separately, the four factors are asset value, likelihood of threat, severity of vulnerabilities, and the impact, which sometimes for intangible assets is incorporated into the value of the asset, then if we measure all of this, then we can combine them and come up with a measure of the risk. Now, don't try to find a closed form function like this to compute the risk. There is no way. We use empirical ways of combining the values of the four elements of risk to come up with the risk. Now, where does that lead us with respect to risk assessment in critical infrastructure? There are a lot, and I will show you a slide with a long list of methodologies for assessing risk in critical infrastructures. But one thing we need to make clear from the beginning is that there is a difference between a risk assessment and impact assessment. And there is also a difference, which is not on the slide, But there is a difference between risk assessment and threat assessment, and the difference between risk assessment and vulnerability assessment. What is the difference? Risk assessment requires an assessment of the threat, of the vulnerability, and of the impact, in addition to the value of the asset, right? Each one of them separately does not give you a good overview of the risk. They have to be considered all together. And I actually gave you a hint on how this can happen. If you have a vulnerability that cannot be exploited by any threat, do you have a risk? Obviously not. But the vulnerability itself might be assessed as high. That doesn't mean that the risk is high. Or there might be a high vulnerability, there might be a high likelihood of threat, but the impact is minimal. So if we don't consider all the elements together, then we just reach a wrong decision about the risk. And this is what is meant here. Now, if we are to somehow discuss what are the differences in the methodologies of risk assessment and what are their characteristics, obviously the scope is important, the audience, because there are different methodologies used for different audiences. If you address policymakers, they don't want to need to know the details. They never want to know the details. They just want the big picture. Same with decision makers. If the audience is researchers, then we are interested in very tiny details. If you are an operator, then of course, again, you need to have both the overall picture and to the priority list of the risks, but also the technical details about it, and so on and so forth. And finally, the domain of applicability of the methodology. So we have methodologies that assess risk at the asset level, individual asset, or at the system level, or at the system of systems, which is the systemic level. So the one methodology that we will discuss gives you this this flavor, at least partially. Then another important element that has to be discussed when we discuss risk assessment in critical infrastructure is the interdependencies. You will discuss critical infrastructure interdependencies in detail with Stephen in his lectures, and in fact how to model interdependencies. But for now, suffices it to say that we have four types of interdependencies that are related to critical infrastructures in general, and two more on the next slide that relate to the sector. So we have physical interdependencies in the case that the operation of one infrastructure depends on the output of the other. An example, the transportation infrastructure, at least the train, depends on the electrical infrastructure. No electricity, no train. Okay. That's one example. Then we have cyber interdependencies. So the dependency lies in the information that is transmitted. An example of two infrastructures that are interdependent in a cyber interdependency. Telecom and banking. Banking depends on telecom networking to do its job. Then you have geographic dependency on local effects. A good example here is that if you have an event in a local, let's say, nuclear facility, then obviously other infrastructure in the area will be affected adversely. And this is kind of a geographic interdependency. And then finally, we have an everything else kind of interdependency, which is called logical, which is anything that cannot be classified as one of the other three. And then, as I said, we have also cross-sectoral interdependencies, so we can have interdependencies between different sectors, and in fact, the examples that we discussed previously were all intersectoral, but in fact, you can also have sectoral interdependency. So within the same sector, two infrastructures can be dependent. An example, if you go to the energy sector, the distribution system operator is interdependent with the transmission system operator. And both of them are interdependent with the production system, right? So things like that. Okay, now, people often ask, how do I assess a methodology? Which one shall I use, right? Well, there are several criteria, and this is why we don't have wide consensus on which one of the existing methods is the best, simply because there is no consensus about the criteria themselves. So, but criteria that you can use is, first of all, the scope. Some of them are very limited in scope, so they have been designed to address risk only in a particular kind of infrastructure. And they are not applicable to others. Then you should look at the objectives. You should look at the techniques they apply and what standards they are compliant with. It's very important that any risk assessment methodology that you employ is compliant with the standards, both the cross-sectoral and the sectoral standards. Then what kind of interdependencies does the methodology cover? Does it cover all? Does it cover none of the interdependencies? Resilience usually is not addressed, but it's something that you need to consider, whether the methodology does give you guidance for resilience. And finally, if it is a cross-sectoral methodology, how are the risks across sectors compared? Can they be prioritized? So all these are things that one should consider when trying to decide which method to use in a particular infrastructure. And just to make things a little bit worse, this is a list, it's not complete, of several risk assessment methodologies for critical infrastructures. Okay? So if you are to pick one to use, it's not a very, very easy task. But to be honest, most people rely on the experience of others that have used a methodology in their own sector or domain, or possibly even in the same infrastructure. Or the selection is guided because of company policies. Okay? So scientifically, it would take a long and difficult task to select what is the best method to use in this particular case. But in practice, this is not so much difficult simply because the decision is guided by other considerations, other than scientific. What is interesting is that in Europe at least, there are several such methods, and several of them are sponsored by specific countries. So the problem has already arisen that if we want to see, to have a view of the systemic risk across Europe, then we do not have compatible methods of risk assessment used across different European countries. So France has a methodology for assessing the systemic risk within France, and then the Netherlands have another one, and then the British, well, the British are not in the European Union anymore, but anyway, they have their own one, the Germans have their own, and so on and so forth. Spanish have another one. And the problem then is, if you focus on the energy infrastructure, for example, the electrical energy, right? Well, you know that the electrical network in Europe, it's all interconnected, right? So the Norwegian grid is interconnected with all the other grids in Europe. And this is holds true for all other countries, right? So can we answer the question, fine, what is the systemic risk of the European grid, power grid, right? Based on the results of the risk assessment of the Norwegian grid, of the French grid, of the German grid, and so on and so forth. Can we do that? And unfortunately, the answer is that we don't really know whether we can do it, because the methodologies that have been used to assess the national risk are not compatible. So to make it simple, suppose that the country A has come up with a systemic risk, I will just give you one number, right, of 6 for their grid. And then another country has come up with an 8 in the same scale. Assume that the scale is the same, it goes up to 10, right? Does that tell you what is the combined risk of putting those two together? The answer is no, because first of all, you don't know how that 6 of the first country was computed, based on what method, right? And what the 8 of the second country meant actually in terms of risk. This is the reason that ENISA recently, last year, started the project for creating a bridge between those risk assessment methodologies so that we could interpret the results of each other when put together. Already there are some results from the first year of the operation. I was part of the team, and I am still part of the team that is producing this mapping across the methodologies. Quite interesting type of work, including because you see there that there are national preferences, which of course is understandable. If a country is used to using their own methodology, they would understandably want to go into that direction for the overall European one. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that these are things that are not only technical. There is policy there, there is politics also sometimes, there is regulation, there is other things other than technology. Okay, but let's stick to the scientific part of it. Okay, well, I already gave you a few little criticism on what these the problems are with these methods, so I will not spend more time on this one. But what are the challenges? Well, a list of challenges, right? Why can't we come up with something that will be broadly accepted? Well, the very first problem is that we have not found a way to model everything in a critical infrastructure, right? So we don't have the widely accepted modeling approach. And again, you will be discussing modeling of infrastructures with Stephen in his lectures. But again, just for the discussion that we need to have here, we distinguish between structural or topological methods. You know that. I mean, you usually use a graph to represent a network, for example. Well, this is a structural or a topological model. But does it give you everything there? And yes, of course, it gives you the nodes, because these are assets, perhaps, right? It has the edges, which means that it gives you the connections of nodes among them. But is this all the information you need? And usually, such a representation does not give you, for example, functionality relationships. It gives you communication and information flow, but it doesn't give you any functionality information. Then there are logical methods. There are functional methods, which give you the information on how the transfer functions, for example, move from one place to the other in the system, but they don't necessarily give you the topological information. And there are flow methods on how information flows or control flows or things like that. So a unifying modeling approach that would put all those together is still to be found. And possibly it's not possible to come up with one that would represent everything. There are several modeling approaches that are being researched. Among them, one of my PhD students has done some work on modeling cyber-physical systems or industrial control systems. She has come up with several bright ideas about new ways of modeling, but still nothing near all the four classes of methods there. Okay. And, of course, there is a different classification. We can talk about the classification of modeling and analysis in critical infrastructure. So I would, again, I will not spend time on this. just this, all this discussion is geared towards showing you that it's not a trivial task to do a risk assessment in critical infrastructures, and we don't have all the tools or the instruments that we would need to do that. So there are still open research points there. Now, coming to a particular risk assessment, because it combines several of those challenges, it addresses several of those challenges, particularly the interdependency challenge and how this works. And it has been used in practical situations as well. So it's good to give you some more insight of what we're talking here about. So here we have the following situation. We look at infrastructures at three layers. We have the infrastructure itself, we have the sector level, and finally we have the national sector. So if you consider, for example, the power infrastructure, the first level would be what? A particular factory producing electrical energy. That's the infrastructure level, the lowest one. Then the sector level would be what? All the factories producing energy and also distributing energy, right? And what would be the national? Well, the national would be not only directed towards this sector, but taking into consideration all the sectors of critical infrastructures in a particular country, okay? So this is how it works. We don't go below the infrastructure or the level one, which means that this methodology doesn't go into the particular assets of a power-producing company. It looks at the power-producing company as one piece of asset. Right? Doesn't go below. And this is here represented graphically. Now, CIO stands for Critical Infrastructure Operator. So at this level, which is the lower level, we assume that all the assets within the infrastructure have been identified, and a risk analysis has been done. So what we do at this level, we try to identify interdependencies, and we try to identify interdependencies. Why? Because we are interested in seeing how the risk is transferred between infrastructure. So this level actually tries to produce enough information so that we can answer the question, fine, if I know the risk of this particular power-producing company and the risk of that and the risk of the third, can I put them together and somehow get a picture of what is the risk of all the sector? That's what this aims at. Okay. So how does it work? Well, the first step is to identify all the CIOs, that the operators that are participating in that, and the corresponding dependencies. And for each dependency, we need to specify what is the type. Remember the types that we discussed, whether it's a physical, a cyber, a geographic, or a logical, which includes social. Then the source impact, which means what is the impact coming from the source of the interdependency, the incoming impact, the type of incoming impact, is it financial, is it safety, is it loss of service, several types of impact. Then the scale of the impact, is it, it's a five value scale here, from very low to very high. And the likelihood of incoming impact, again, a five-level scale. Now, these give you, I mean, the type and the scale give you a qualitative assessment of what the impact coming into this CIO is. And when we combine this with the likelihood, it allows us to assess what is called the incoming dependency risk. And we will see how we do this in step two. So this is step two. Based on a risk matrix, we can estimate the incoming risk based on the threat values and the vulnerability values. Then in step three, we create a matrix like this one for each critical infrastructure operator, where you can see the matrix is actually for, let's say, CIO Sabai, that's the IF operator, where you just have all the dependencies put there by the dependency type, the description, this is a textual description, what is the source impact, and the legend is below the table here, what is the incoming impact, which would be high, very high, low, very low, and medium, impact type, impact scale, and the likelihood, and then finally, what this all this gives you is the result of the risk of the interdependent CIOs on a scale between 1 to 9. And in fact, the overall risk of that matrix would be the maximum of each one of the individual risks identified here. We'll see an example, so I hope things will become clearer later. But let's first discuss, since we are at this slide, the inherent assumption here is that when I have several risks that are involved in the interdependent, between the interdependent infrastructures A and B, then the risk that I should consider for these two is the maximum of all risks. How do you comment on this? Is this the only option we have? Other options? That's a guiding question, actually. It's a leading question, but... First of all, is the question clear? I'm looking at your two fellow students locally here. I can't see anyone on Blackboard or remote. Again, so what I'm asking is this. You have two interdependent infrastructures, right? And these interdependencies, it's not only one dependency, there are different types of dependency. So you may have a cyber dependency between them, and you may also have allocation, a geographical dependence, right? And the risk because of the existence of the cyber dependence is, let's say, 5. And the risk because of the geographic or the location dependence is 6. So what I'm saying here is that the overall risk because of the interdependence is 6, which is the maximum of the two. And the question is this the only option? Take the maximum? Or is it the best option among others? It's a reasonable option. The answer is that it is a reasonable option. Okay, I mean, of course, these two different values of risk give you a measurement of different things, right? Because one is the measure of what is the risk because of the cyber dependence, and the other one is because of the geographical dependence, right? So one could say that, hang on a minute here, you're asking whether we can somehow combine a measure of apples with a measure of oranges, right? And what I'm actually saying by picking the maximum is that, okay, which are most? Is it the oranges more than the apples or what? And then we go with the oranges. Fine, I mean, maybe it doesn't make sense, but it does give you at least one measure if you want to combine those risks, because the ultimate goal is not to focus on this particular dependence, but the ultimate goal of the whole methodology is what? To give you an overview of how this will affect other infrastructures within the sector and other sectors within the country, right? So if you look at the big picture, the question of whether the maximum operator is the appropriate one to use, and actually there is no other. I mean, of course, you could take the average, right? But But then it would be adding apples and oranges and dividing by two. Not a very, very much better option, is it? Okay. So actually what we're saying is that if the oranges here are more than the apples, then we prioritize the oranges. That's the idea, okay? Which makes some sense. A much more interesting question is this, and you will face it in your professional lives for sure, when you do risk assessments. We usually do this by asking people around, what do you perceive this risk to be? High, medium, or low, right? So suppose that you ask someone, and the answer that you get is that this particular risk, it doesn't matter which risk it is high. And then you ask the next guy, and he or she says, it's low. And then the third one says high again, and the fourth one says medium, and so on. What do you decide? What is the risk? How would you approach it? It's very real, I assure you. One approach would be to take the maximum. This is the worst case, actually, right? I mean, the rationale behind it, okay, someone said it's high, so let's approach it as being high. What's the disadvantage of that approach? Why do we assess risks? Because we want to drive our decisions about the countermeasures. Yes, Marius? Yes. Absolutely correct. This is one thing you should know. And actually, I have withheld much information that I will give you gradually. I mean, to make a decision, you need that and other things as well. But I tried to make it simple at the first approach. So we will go into this. Gloria is right, yes. So is it understood? Well, we do the risk assessment because we want to guide our decision about countermeasures, right? So what is the consequence of deciding that the risk is high? Wouldn't then you expect that this would be prioritized and therefore that you would have to design or apply countermeasures for that risk as a matter of priority? And wouldn't that in turn imply, because you have a limited budget, right, that you would, I mean, your budget is not unlimited, unfortunately. So you would spend money on this one, and you possibly would not spend on something else based on the information that this is a high risk. Clear what the disadvantage is? Okay. Other options. Of course, you are on the safe side with this particular risk because you assume that it is high, and therefore, even if it's not in reality high, then no problem, right? Other options. Another option is, okay, I have four people saying that it is high, I have three people saying that it is low, and I have six people saying that it's medium. Let's average. Again, rather on the safe side. But again, is this the right thing to do? I mean, this is like rolling dice. Because you are actually averaging subjective opinions. So what is the right approach? Well, first of all, you need to know that any risk assessment is by nature subjective. You cannot get rid of subjectivity. So in whatever approach you take, you should have this in mind. And because it is subjective, one thing that you need to consider is this person that assessed the risk, how much does he or she know about risk assessments, right? Because obviously this affects their assessment of risk. That's what Gloria said. Now there are other factors as well. And another important factor is, yes? Absolutely, yes, absolutely. This is correct, and we already, yeah, we discussed it as one of the disadvantages, the main disadvantage of taking the highest risk. But it's correct, yes. So what else? Well, what is also important is what is the function of the person that assesses risk with regards to the risk itself. Now, let me make this a little bit clearer. Who is the owner of a risk? Who owns the risk in an organization? Obviously, it's the management. Yeah, it's their responsibility. Right? Remember what the risk is, right? It's related to the impact on assets. Who is responsible for safeguarding the assets? It's the management, right? So the owner of the risk is the manager, eventually, right? Okay. So suppose then again, in a scenario that you have interviewed the end user of a service, and he or she tells you that the risk of this service becoming unavailable is extremely high. And why is it extremely high? Well, naturally, because if the service is not there, he or she cannot do her job. So she feels helpless, right? That's natural, and it's again human nature. But when you talk to the manager, right, the manager says, oh, come on, nothing will really happen. And I can give you many examples like this. Suppose that you have a service that runs in the background of an organization, right? And it's not outward looking at all. So at most, if it's unavailable, what it will happen, it will slow things down in the back end, right? But it will not be visible, and therefore the impact will not be that much. But the people that use the service to do their job will be very much adversely affected, and therefore they are likely to give you very high assessment of the risk of unavailability of the service. So, who do you listen to? It's the manager you listen to. It's the risk owner that you will listen to, right? Then there are other factors. There is the attitude of people towards IT in general. Not all people have the same positive attitude towards IT and the use of IT and so on and so forth, particularly in other countries, not in Norway, but in other countries you would even find a hostile attitude towards IT. And this, of course, affects the subjectivity of assessing risk and so on and so forth. So, do not average, do not take the maximum. But use your judgment in who to listen to. But of course, there is always the possibility of adjusting scores, right? And using the judgment is the best thing you can do. Okay, but here we use the maximum, and the rationale again is, as I said, that we want to focus on the bigger picture rather than specific items in the picture. Okay. Now, who provides the input here? Well, the input at this stage is provided by the operators themselves, but also from sector representatives, because these probably have a better view of the potential dependencies between the operators than the operators themselves. And at this level, at the sectoral level, of course, we use the interdependencies that have been identified in the previous stage, I mean at the CIO level, but more can be added because of the overview, the better overview here. And what we assess in this stage is what is called the outgoing risk of an infrastructure. So in the first stage, what we did was we assessed what is the risk to my infrastructure because I'm dependent on others, right? Now what we do is what? I assess the risk. What is the risk of my infrastructure to the others because I'm dependent on them? Okay? So incoming and outgoing risk. Well, how is this done? Again, one has to identify the dependencies and the dependent infrastructures and so on. And again, you have to find the types and all this. And as you would expect, you have a similar table that needs to be compiled. And again, of course, the principle of taking the maximum applies here when we have multiple dependencies between the same pair of CIOs. And this, interestingly enough, it's called SR, where S stands for societal. Because it is you affecting others. That's the rationale behind it. Okay. Then the next step here is to estimate the societal risk. This is the matrix, and this would give you a result like this one for each one of the CIOs. And again, here we apply the maximum societal risk principle, so the worst case scenario. Then, in the next step at the sector level, step four, we estimate the overall incoming and outgoing dependency risk, and these are designated by these variables there, and then, based on all this, the coordinators can compute the overall dependency risk for each one of the participating CIOs. And then, of course, we can prioritize, we can do all sorts of things with that list. And finally, of course, the overall societal risk can also be. Yes. Well, you know what? It might be a reminder of the time, but I don't. No, I don't think it's so smart. maybe, because the other times that it has shut itself down, it had nothing to do with the time. Yeah. Anyway. We will break soon, so let's just start it again. Yeah, okay. Right. Okay. Let's break here, because this is the last now level, which is the national or intra-sector level. I will recap a little bit the stages again in the next lecture, and we will also discuss this in detail. And then, as you might have seen in the slides, there is a worked out example, so we will go through the example, and things will hopefully become clear with the example. Now, next week, first of all, tomorrow we don't have a lecture. Okay, I'll be in the Forschware Forschungsinstitut for a visit. Next week, on Thursday, you will have the tutorial with Dr. Kaligar. She has made an announcement. Right? It will be on Blackboard, so she will not be physically here. And that will be on Thursday. On Friday, we will have a lecture together in the afternoon. I have not yet made an announcement. I will do it as usual. You might have seen the pattern that I do this over the weekend, usually. So there will be an announcement. And we will meet in Blackboard next week for my lecture as well, because I will be in Copenhagen for a conference, the Azorix conference. So watch out for announcements in Blackboard. Everything will be hopefully clear there. Okay? Any questions right now? Before we close, anything from Blackboard? No? Okay. Thank you then. Have a nice afternoon. And because I will not be meeting you tomorrow, have a nice weekend.